Our fathers bled at Valley Forge. The snow was red with blood, their faith was warm. At Valley Forge, their faith was brotherhood.
Wasn't that a time to thrive? The soul of man, wasn't that a terrible time?
Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Today I'm delighted because we have a very special interview to share with you. Harold Leventhal has had a varied career as a personal manager, music publisher, theatrical and film producer, and concert promoter spanning the last 50 years. He first started in the music business in 1939 as a song plugger for the Irving Berlin Music Company. Like so many others, Mr. Leventhal was drawn to folk music by the music of Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, and the Almanac Singers. Because of his facility for the business side of the music, Mr. Leventhal found himself helping to organize concerts, and by 1950 began his career as a personal manager for Pete Seeger and the Weavers. Over his incredible career, Mr. Leventhal has represented such outstanding artists as Cisco Houston, Judy Collins, The Tarriers, Theodore Bickel, Alan Arkin, and Arlo Guthrie. Since 1954, Harold has represented the interests of Woody Guthrie and is the executor of the Guthrie Estate and the Guthrie Archives. As a concert promoter, Harold was the first to bring folk music artists to the stages of New York's great concert halls, presenting the Weavers, Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, the Clancy Brothers, and Tommy Makem, Joni Mitchell, and many others from all over the world. Mr. Leventhal produced the Woody Guthrie film biography Bound for Glory, which in 1976 received two Academy Awards. He was also producer of the film Alice's Restaurant, starring Arlo Guthrie in documentary films. Mr. Leventhal co-produced with Jim Brown the classic film about the Weavers' reunion, Wasn't That a Time? And in 1989 received an Emmy Award for the television film We Shall Overcome. Mr. Leventhal received a Grammy Award as producer of the Columbia record, A Tribute to Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly, in the same year. Leventhal continues working with Pete Seeger and the Guthrie Estate and is active with many production and publishing projects. He has been tireless in his devotion to folk music and the people who create and perform it. Welcome, Harold Leventhal.
Thank you very much. I know that I probably couldn't edit that introduction for you, edit it down perhaps, but it spans a long time, certainly from 1939 to the present. And my career in the folk music is really started in 1950 with the Weavers.
How did it happen?
Well, I had gone down to the nightclub Village Vanguard to listen to the Weavers who were working there. And the only one that I knew was Pete Seeger. And I was really taken by the group and went backstage to say hello to him. And he just spoke up and said, would I be interested in managing the Weavers? I had no experience in managing, but I knew plenty managers. So I quickly said yes. And the rest became history.
Pete told us in an interview we did with him quite some time ago about his dissatisfaction with an earlier manager. Do you have to be tough in this business in order to do this?
Well, not so much as tough as being honest and doing that that serves the best interests of the talent that you represent, not yourself. And I think that was a problem there.
So let me ask you this, Mr. Leventhal. Can I call you Harold?
Sure.
Harold, how did you start? I mean, you grew up in New York City?
Actually, I was born in the Catskill Mountains in
Ellenville.
And my family moved to the Lower East Side, and I was brought up on the Lower East Side, then on the South Bronx. Then from then, I went in the Army, etc. I had been in the music business prior to that, so I went back into the music business with a small company among some friends.
What did you do in the Army?
Well, I was in the Signal Corps, and I was stationed in India for 2 years, which was a huge experience for me. I'm still sort of Indiophile because of that experience.
You've had a love affair with India, I'm told.
That's right.
For many years.
I keep saying that I'm probably the last American. I spent a week with Mahatma Gandhi, and that was a great experience.
Well, tell us about him. What was Mahatma Gandhi like?
Well, he's like described a very religious man and a very philosophical. He was curious, asking me as to why American soldiers were in India. He asked me who Truman was, who had just become president. We didn't know much about him either. And he was very concerned that we get to understand the problems that India had at that time.
So what was it like being in the presence of this kind of great man? Were you, as a young man, in awe of this?
No, I wasn't. I knew about Gandhi, as any intelligent person should know. The whole atmosphere was something that you can just walk into his room, you can hang around all day. He was in an ashram, and just treated like anybody would be treated. So there was nobody stopping you from going to see him, hanging around with him, and I hung around with him.
Did he teach you anything?
No.
So tell me, what were your parents like, Harold?
Well, unfortunately, my father died 8 weeks after I was born. My mother was had to bring up five children alone. So that's why we lived the East Side at that time. So I was brought up with a mother, no family.
What do you remember about her?
Well, great memories. She was concerned about her family, see that everybody went the straight way, and they did.
Was she a gutsy woman? Because you're a gutsy man.
No, she was a disciplinarian only to that extent. You had to toe the line, which was, of course, a good thing. But she was a fair person and an understanding person.
What did Judaism mean in your life?
Well, I was brought up in an Orthodox family where I was observing pretty much every holiday and all that. It meant family unity to me. At one point, I really wanted to study to be a rabbi, but I shifted into the political realm, and that took me away from that.
When you say it shifted to the political realm, let's follow that thread.
Well, I was a left-wing Zionist at one time, Shama HaTzair, and that left me into the socialist groups in New York.
Has that followed you in your life, too? Or?
Yes, very much so.
How so?
Well, it gave me an understanding of how to deal with people, to deal with them properly, to deal with them honestly, to deal with what's the best for the situation. And if you keep that up, then you have your own self-respect. And I've tried to do that all my life.
Would you identify yourself as a socialist to this day?
In a sense, yes.
What's the sense?
Well, I'm not identifying any particular group,
sure,
or political party, but I am identifying a socialist perspective of things that's very hard to come by.
Okay, so let me name some names, and you tell me what you remember about them, okay? Irving Berlin.
Well, I knew him quite well. I was one of his favorite boys in the company. He was kind of aloof from everybody in the office. He wasn't much of a talker, didn't mix much with people, but he was held in great respect. And I was in the room with him when he first wrote White Christmas.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know. Where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow.
I remember listening to it and shrugging my shoulders whether this is going to be a big song or not. Because he would play the piano, but he couldn't write out the music. So he'd bring somebody in. And
yeah, that famous piano that you could crank up,
right,
to put it in different keys.
Yeah.
What did you do for him?
I became a song plugger. In other words, at that time, you went after the big bands or the singers on radio. And you'd go around to meet them and promote a particular song that the company was pushing at that time.
Did you have to sing it yourself?
No. Just showed them the sheet music and talked to their arranger who did the song, and tried to get it on the program for them.
You just think about what that man's contribution was when you think of White Christmas, God Bless America.
Oh, it was tremendous.
Yeah.
Tremendous.
People say he could be a curmudgeon. Could he?
probably.
What about Benny Goodman?
Benny Goodman was another very interesting guy. He was always working. And the company I was with, Regent Music Company, which he was part of, was run by his brothers, two brothers, Harry Goodman, who used to be a bass player in his orchestra, and Gene, the younger. They were wonderful guys to work with. It was a happy-go-lucky office. But Benny was a stickler. Everything had to be exact. And musicians working for him always felt threatened by him. And they were, you know. I didn't have that much to do with him as such. But the time I was with him, I got along with him. I did what he wanted.
And did he reward you?
No.
So I see a picture of Frank Sinatra on your wall. What did you have to do with him?
Well, that's part of Benny Goodman thing. Benny was booked into the Paramount Theater, which at that time was the big, big activity. And usually he had Peggy Lee, a female singer, and he had a male singer. And he had a singer who was booked and who backed out of it the last minute. And he was at the office then, very concerned, and said to go and he'd get him a singer. I knew Sinatra at that time. And I merely suggested to get Frank Sinatra. So he ordered me to go get him.
Really?
Which I did. And right in the same building, he had his office. So luckily, at that time, Sinatra had a free schedule. Actually, it was that engagement that really put Sinatra on the map of crowds. Thousands of kids came to see him. And that was a lucky break for him.
Now nothing's impossible. I have found, for when my chin is on the ground, I pick myself up, dust myself off, and start all over again. Don't lose your confidence if you slip. Be grateful for a pleasant trip, and to pick yourself up, dust off, start over again. Work like a soul inspired.
You think life is made up of these lucky breaks?
Oh, constantly. Yeah.
Who were the early influences on your life that you would point to say, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for this person?
Well, so much of it is accidental. Before I was in the music business, I worked in a factory right down in Greenwich Village, a factory left over from medieval times. And I was in the union. There was a union involved. And I was in the left wing of the union. And they had a convention and they got rid of us. So I was out of a job. And a brother of mine suggested there was something at Irving Berlin's. Well, at that time, you took any job that came along. You didn't decide what you wanted to do. And I had no experience. I never went to college or anything like that. So I took that job and that started me off.
What do you remember about the Depression?
Everybody around you in the same situation. I know many friends of my mother's, their husbands didn't work. And there was no unemployment at that time. There was very little welfare at that time. And I know relatives just didn't have jobs or in between jobs. We didn't have a car or any of these things. But you accepted it, or at least you understood it, because everybody around you was in the same circumstance.
How dramatic was it? I mean, did it influence the way that you approached money or approached people for the rest of your life?
Yeah, I think it did. From then on, you always counted your money before you bought anything. You didn't take risks in buying things at all. That was it. I remember we bought a radio in a house in the South Bronx then, and I used to go every week with a quarter to pay for that radio. Nobody had bank accounts. So everything was paying by individual payments. And if you had to pay your bill for electric bill or gas, you went, there was a store that accepted those things. So everything was counted, and you weren't sure that it would continue.
My folks lived through the Depression, and I think I've been influenced by the way they approach money as a second-generation person.
Sure. I had three older brothers. They quit junior high school to go to work. So the question of even finishing high school was questionable because you had to go out and work.
So how did you meet Woody Guthrie?
Well, I met him, I think it was around 1949. I went to a Hootenanny, and he was there. I first met him then.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
But I knew about him as a writer and as a journalist, but I didn't get to meet him until the Weavers. Because he used to come around to rehearsals, and he was very close, of course, to Pete and to Lee Hayes. And then I would get to talk to him and find out what's happening. It was a rocky period for him. It was really the beginning. You can sense that there's something. This guy wasn't behaving properly.
What are the manifestations?
He couldn't hold a guitar properly. He was slightly shaking. But we attribute all of these little problems as being drunk.
Mm-hmm.
I would scold him for drinking.
Would he defend himself?
No, he wouldn't. Maybe he knew it was more than that.
So you knew Huddy Ledbetter, yes?
Casually.
Uh-huh.
I admired him. He was a dapper dresser for that period and that time. He was a handsome man.
The Library of Congress, in approaching your office, I saw a book about the man Pete Seeger always calls Old Man Lomax. What were their contributions to folk music in America?
Well, they really made folk music a factor for being part of America, for other parts of America to recognize it. And that's what they do. They made you recognize it. Folk music is a vital cultural element on the American scene.
They're almost forgotten in many quarters now. But the Library of Congress lives on as one of the great repositories of American culture and folk music, which, of course, they did.
Yes.
And how important do you think that Library of Congress collection was in the development of American folk music?
I think it was vital. There's no other place that was doing anything about it. There was no other recognition, but on a very limited scale, perhaps. But this was a national scale and a national recognition. And they brought it to the attention of many, many other elements.
Let's pick up the story a little bit. You say you met Pete Seeger at the Village Vanguard.
Yes.
And that's where you became the manager. What did a manager do?
Well, a manager is really a coordinator. Sees that things are properly organized, particularly if a group wants to make a living at what they're doing. How do you make a living? What do you have to do in terms of getting a record contract? You want to perform, where do you perform, making up schedules, working on programs or how to perform. And the manager is the coordinator of all of these activities.
Did you ever get involved in the actual substance of what they were singing or how they were singing?
Yes.
Could you tell me a little about that?
Well, first, we recognized that the Weavers was more than just a singing group. It was a group that had a political philosophy, a social philosophy, and what they were to sing about had to reflect their individual attitudes on this. And as a manager, you have to agree with that. If you don't agree with that, you shouldn't be the manager. I was always in agreement with that, and that's one of the reasons why during the blacklisting period, I stood fast with them as they suffered from it, you know. But I think the Weavers were unique, bringing that kind of music to the forefront of the American public. And that came through hit records.
In 1950, you met them. Then the blacklist came. Were you blacklisted personally?
I couldn't get a passport. The FBI had a file on me, but I was never called before a committee.
Wonder why they didn't reach out to you, because after all, you had to do with all these artists, and they were doing this witch hunting at the time. Why would they leave you alone?
Well, they didn't, in a sense, they didn't leave me alone, but they didn't call me before a committee meeting.
Right.
But they would come to my house, try to interview me, come to the office, and I never agreed to speak to them. That was it.
Did they browbeat you?
No.
No. So let's pick up the Weavers. You are a legend, of course, to everybody who knows the story, and Pete always credits you for everything that you did. But after the Blacklist, and after they had to bust up, and after they weren't getting any jobs anywhere, you decided it was time. Now, I think of two guys. I think of Edward R. Murrow and what he was able to do with McCarthy on See It Now. And I think of you, because you had an idea to bring them together for this legendary concert at Carnegie Hall. What year was that?
55.
Now, how many seats does Carnegie Hall hold?
2,800.
2,800. And yet 2 million people say they were at that concert.
They snuck in.
So tell me, what gave you the idea that maybe it was time to challenge the accepted notion that these guys were too hot to handle and that it wasn't going to work?
Well, I felt it would work. I felt that we could get 2,800 people in the New York area, whether they're coming from New Jersey or Westchester County. We would get that many people. Whether we'd get that in Boston or in Philadelphia, I wasn't sure. But I felt that this was needed. I had to stir this up again. And that there was a core of these people there. Actually, the first ad that we put on, it was a tremendous response to it. And it worked.
When I was a kid, and there would be one little tiny Pete Seeger or Weavers announcement in the paper, not more than an inch or so high, and it would sell out. Every one of those concerts would sell out. What was that about?
Well, I think there's a feeling of that public that they supported the Weavers, what they're doing. They wanted to show that they're with you and support you, and they really come out. And they've been coming out for years at Carnegie Hall.
Well, once a year, there's always a concert. It's always
every
been a concert.
Year. Whether it was originally the Weavers and then it became Pete Seeger, then it was Pete and Arlo, and then it was Arlo alone. We've had that particular weekend we've had for 35 to 40 years now.
When you were cracking the Blacklist, was Carnegie reticent to rent you the space?
No, right away. First of all, I had a little more trouble with Lincoln Center. Didn't want to, at least avoided signing a lease. And I countered that by saying that this was a public auditorium supported by public funds, and they have no right to disallow. Quickly changed, and I did get a couple of dates there. At Carnegie, right from the start, they just accepted us. Because at one time, the town hall wouldn't accept us. Or at least hedging, you know. And there aren't too many places in Manhattan you can go to.
Do you remember the night of the concert?
It was to 55?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
What do you remember?
Well, there was a tremendous excitement. It's as if, you know, people finally let out of jail.
Yeah.
That feeling of exuberance. And it was a sense of the victory, everybody participating in a victory.
A lot of people have gone to jail. Wasn't that a time, Lee Hayes and
sure.
Pete wrote? And so here were all these people in this room. I've never heard anything like it. I wasn't there, but I have never heard anything like that, that crowd. What was Harold Leventhal, who was after all responsible for this, what was he feeling then?
Well, I felt vindicated, of course, and I felt that I was right, and I was right for the right reasons, and that it worked. And also that unless you try it, unless you go forward with something, how do you know? And why shouldn't you go forward?
I'll name some other names. Tell me about your recollections of them and how you worked with them. Joan Baez.
I worked with Joan for the very first year of her career.
How'd you find her?
Through a friend in Boston who managed her, Manny Greeno. We were friends, and I admired Joan. She was a very creative person, a beautiful singer, a disciplined singer, and a responsible person.
You got to walk that lonesome valley. You got to yourself, ain't nobody here gonna walk it for you.
What'd you do for her?
Well, I did all of her concerts in the New York area, mostly either Town Hall or Carnegie Hall for years.
She's had a wild ride. Did you ever ask her advice about any of it?
Yes. I had to do a lot of political questions, and I supported her, and at times I may have disagreed with her, but we've been friends all along.
Still?
Oh, yeah.
How does that manifest itself, the current friendship?
Well, occasionally she'll drop me a note, you know, she'll ask how are things. When she's around New York, I try to see her, but she's also constantly on the go.
She's amazing. Judy Collins?
We're very friendly. I've been working with her for a number of years, but we see each other time to time. Or she'll ask me, she'll consult with me about problems that arise. I try to help her.
What kind of problems? Without giving away.
Managerial problems, recording problems, business type of problems.
How would you contrast the careers of Joan Baez and Judy Collins, coming from a man who has engaged in management with both of them?
Well, they're both marvelous singers. I think Joan was ahead of Judy in many ways. But right now, they're both equal in a sense that they both find, you know, it's difficult to get their public together again. But they've had a long time of career, at least 40 years or more.
Harold Odenthal, let's go back to the Blacklist a little bit because it's an interesting time. We had people, you said you weren't called, but there were people who were called to the committee. For example, Burl Ives was called. And I remember when he died, Pete got on National Public Radio, and he was asked about how he felt about Burl, and he said something like, Burl has forgiven me for things that I did. I have forgiven him for what he did. And yet, he became sort of an anathema in the community. Do you remember those times?
Well, I had an incident with Burl Ives. Years back when Woody was still around, we had started the Guthrie Children's Fund. I was in charge of it, and we were going around with friends to get some money to organize. And Burl was doing a show on Broadway, so I went backstage to see him. And when I identified myself as I have the Woody Guthrie thing, he wouldn't see me.
You have any idea what that was about?
Well, and he wanted nothing to do with Woody. And we wanted nothing to do with him. Then there was another incident about it. Will Geer told me this happened to him. Will Geer, it was at an airport, I think, in San Francisco, and he met Burl Ives at the airport. And Will did go over to him. And Burl, according to Will Geer, literally cried to say how miserable he felt what's happened to Woody, and he literally asked for forgiveness, which Will said he certainly gave him.
And then there was the ongoing saga, and I've talked to all the participants of this, of Oscar Brand. Now, Oscar Brand has been, you know, a lion in the folk music industry, of course, and he has told me that he felt that he was unfairly tarnished by those who felt that he had been cooperative with the people who were doing the red baiting and the red scaring. Could you shed any light on this one?
I think it's totally exaggerated. He may have felt that way, but he wasn't.
But he didn't help them.
We may not have helped because we didn't think as an artist or musically he was up to standards. It's on that level. I know Oscar, I've helped him from time to time on things like that. But that he was red-baited in reverse is not so, at least not where I know. I think that was his own conclusion of why he didn't make it.
Peter, Paul, and Mary.
I know them from the very start. I admire their work. I have the best things to say about them.
Oh, the magic dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Annalee. Little Jackie Paper, he loved that rascal Puff, and he brought him strings and sealing wax and other fancy stuff. Oh, Puff, the magic dragon lived
come to know them?
Well, I knew them before they... I knew Mary, because she was singing in various choral groups that Bob DeCormier had and that Pete had. And she would hang around these folk circles.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so, yeah. I'd met her, but I didn't spend much time.
And how did they get together? Do you have any...
They got together. Milt Okun got them together. You know Milt Okun?
I know of Milt Okun's work. I've never met him, but tell us a little about Milt Okun.
Milt Okun came during the Weavers' days. He was a teacher in the school system, but into music and played the guitar and all. He was a good choral leader, group leader. He got Peter, Paul, and Mary together.
Really?
As a group. And he got Al Grossman to be the manager.
Who was Moses Ash, and what was his influence on folk music?
Well, his influence is quite a big influence. I had difficulties with him.
What were they?
Collecting royalties.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How did that work? I'm sorry.
It didn't work.
Well, whose royalties were they? I'm sorry.
Well, they would have been artists or Woody Guthrie.
Yeah. Oh, so he had these record labels, this record label. And
Folkways Records.
Folkways Records.
Nevertheless, he was the first one to put them out.
Right.
Pete, but his organization was questionable.
Questionable in that he couldn't make a profit?
Well, getting royalties was a big hassle. But you got to give him credit. He was the first to put them out, recognizes they can be put out.
Tell me about Pete himself. I mean, this guy is larger than life. He's had an immense impact on every one of us. And you were sort of the guy behind the scenes who was helping make it happen. But what individual characteristics go into being Pete Seeger?
Absolute honesty, integrity. And you put those two together and you can't beat that. Now, in all the years I've worked with Pete, money or contract was of no interest to him. This doesn't say he works for nothing, but you don't put the dollar above him. He works because he wants to. And fortunately, he's made a living at that. If we were to really become part of the music scene, he could have made 10 times that he earned, but he wouldn't allow it. A couple of incidents, I had to work a contract for him somewhere in Virginia, and I told the guy down there, what have you been paying the other people? And he told me, well, I said, they're paying the same thing. You know? And I had to go away, and so I'll mail up the contract to Pete with instructions where to go and all that. And he sees that the figure, I don't want to remember what it was. He thought it was too much. So he goes and calls the guy down at the booking, and it's too much. The next day or so, the guy calls me. He says, never heard of a thing like this, where an artist is cutting his fee down. Yet, you know, he packed the place there and all of that. And one time he did a concert up in Syracuse, and he was in the office the next day, and he was a little annoyed at me. Throws the check he got. Why did he get this big fee? It was probably $5,000, you know. And I said, you got it because the act before you was Peter, Paul, and Mary, got the same fee. They filled it and you filled it. You know? That's why you got it. And I said, I didn't set up the fee. People who booked it set up the fee.
Is he the only artist you've ever represented who got mad when he got too much money?
Oh, yeah.
What's that about?
That's what I would call and tell him. That's the Protestant guilt. And the Seegers have that. Same thing, we were together in Israel. I was doing some concerts there. We were in Tel Aviv, and I was there with my wife, and I said to Pete, we're going in, let's go into Jerusalem. He didn't want to go. I said, why don't you want to go? Because his ancestors came there and ravaged Jerusalem. I said, that was in 1200.
A long time ago.
He wouldn't go.
Really? Tell me about Theo Bikel. How'd you come to know him?
Got to know him through Jack Holzman, from the record company. And he was then quite popular in New York. And he was a good friend and a good guy to work with.
But how did he find you in the first place? This fellow...
Well, Jack Holdman, it was his record company where he got us together.
Now, it's interesting that a guy like Bacall not only was a great folk singer, which he was, of course, but then he went into acting and to doing...
First, he was always in acting first. Folk singing, it was a secondary thing. He did a couple of movies in England that were very good pictures.
I met him one night at a party when I was just a kid, high school, and he was very nice to me. And he had a younger guy sitting next to him. And he saw that I had a banjo, and he said, and a guitar, with my friend had a guitar, and he took them, and he gave it to his cousin, who was Alex Hasselev, who then formed the Tarriers, and they performed When I First Came to This Land in two-part harmony, the likes of which I've never heard before. Amazing. And I was a cynic, saying, he was telling me how his cousin was going to have this new group, and they were going to be a great group. And I'm sort of nudging the guy next to me, being a wise jerk that I was. I said, sure, that everybody is. And he sure showed us. So have you had clients, without naming them, who you didn't want to represent? In other words, they were just too much trouble.
No, I wouldn't take him to begin with.
Well, how would you know in the beginning?
Well, I'll give you an instance of all things. Some came to me in too much drug orientated. I didn't want any part of that. So I signed up to that. I didn't want too many clients because it's hand-holding a lot of it. You have to have the time for it, and you have to give everyone as much time as they need. And I had to turn down, interesting, of Belafonte.
Wow.
Because he wanted me that time to give up everybody else. I didn't think that was fair. Said he would never give up Pete. So I told him it won't work out.
You ever regret that?
No. I've been friendly with him all along and have done things with him after that. So there, you know, I try to stick with people that I like personally, and it's worked quite well for me.
Have you made enough money for yourself?
I live a very comfortable life, yeah.
Mm. Could you have made more?
I could have made more, I'm sure. But that difference wouldn't have made enough for me.
When the Weavers broke up, was that traumatic for you?
No, because it was a thing that was going to happen at that particular time.
Why?
Well, it was tough getting bookings. Freddie Hellerman, who was here now, the Weavers.
Who was your suite mate here in this office, right?
Yeah. He turned around to become an arranger for people. Did a lot of work with Belafonte. Ronnie Gilbert went to live on the West Coast. Lee Hayes paid a little more attention to writing songs. He didn't need that much, but he lived pretty comfortably. So everybody was settled down. Pete was completely going on his own. So they settled down.
Did they come to you for counseling when this was happening?
No, I mean, we talked about it constantly, always at all times. I didn't put myself as a psychiatrist.
I heard a story once that at some point there was some dissonance over some wanting to do more commercial work, cigarette ads, things like that. Pete saying, no, I don't want to do that.
We only did one.
Right.
One ad, you know. And that is because the fellow who was from the commercial outfit was going to sort of break away from the blacklist. And sort of that was a tag for us to want to do it. We did it, but it didn't work. So we never planned to do any more.
Yeah. When Pete left the Weavers and others filled in, did you have a hand in that?
Not as much as they had in picking someone. This was a sort of an internal music question. And they had to pick someone that would fit a substitute for Pete.
When Pete got the Kennedy honor, I was sitting there with tears in my eyes watching this thing. I'm wondering about whether you ever thought it could come so full circle in your lifetime that you would see the guy who had been blacklisted standing up there honored by the President of the United States.
Well, he received a proposal for that honor before this one. He turned it down because he didn't want Reagan to shake his hand. And when Washington called, and they called me first, they want to propose Pete, would he accept it before they would...
This is the Reagan years.
No, this is Clinton.
Yeah.
In other words, before they would announce it, they checked. I said, well, I'll let you know. When I first called Pete, he was reluctant to accept the award. I got a little upset with that, but I told him the award isn't only for him, it's for all of us and for his public. Right away he answered, do I have to wear a tuxedo? Says he accepted that. And it was quite an affair. His whole family was there, and he enjoyed it.
And yet the New York Post during that time went crazy. Lots of articles about, you know, what a bad guy he was and all the rest of it.
Nobody paid attention.
You're about to be honored, Harold, after all of these years, after having been what they call the fifth weaver and all the rest of it. You're about to be the guy on the spot. And
you live long enough.
And Carnegie, oh, I don't believe that for a minute. You're a very spectacular person. And how did this concert come together? Is this supposed to be the last Harold Leventhal Carnegie Hall concert?
It's supposed to be, yes. I'm getting older and facing, you know, physical problems. I wanted to take it easy. And you've got to learn to hand things over to the next generation or to younger people to do the right things.
Is that hard for you?
A little, but not impossible.
Do you have children?
Two children.
What are they doing? What are your kids doing?
Well, I have two daughters. One is in California. One is here in New York. My daughter here in New York used to be the vice president of a radio station. She's now with the Brooklyn Museum, Children's Museum. And I have four grandchildren.
How does that feel?
Great.
How would you compare your sense of family to your accomplishments at work?
Well, I would say the family accomplishments are very good. I've been married 50 years, same wife, and take care of my children.
How important has your wife been to you?
Very important.
Has she helped you in your career?
She's been supportive, constantly, very supportive. She's the one who does all those sculpture pieces.
Oh, yes. Outside of your office, there are these wonderful sculptures of many of the people that you knew and represented, and she did them all. They're astounding. They're very wonderful. So have there been tough times when, you know, you've made decisions that would mean less money for you or matters of principle in which she said go for it?
Oh, yes. She made sure that it was not associated with people from the drug culture.
Well, how did that manifest itself? How did that work?
Well, the people wanted me to manage them, and they had a bad record behind them. And we talked about it. She was negative, and I agreed with her.
What about the public relations aspect of your business? In other words, something tough happens. Pete goes through a rough time, or somebody makes an accusation, or somebody says something like that. Is it you who has to figure out how to handle it?
Well, certainly, if it's Pete, we all sit down and figure out how to handle it. I remember when Pete was called before the Un-American Committee, and then the judge, he was before the judge to be sentenced. I received a call from his lawyer who told me to stay in the office, not to go down there. Then he called me to say, can I come up with some money, put up for bail? I had a few hours to collect several thousands of dollars, which I borrowed from people. And I came down there, and my wife was with me, and she signed the release for Pete, and she handed over the money. Pete was a little disappointed. He got out of jail too quickly.
You did a benefit for Pete around that time, didn't you?
The committee called for Pete's sake. It was all over the world, you know. When political problems would come up, we would discuss it. We never backed away from it, never. If we were to do a concert and we knew there were pickets there, we'd go through the back and get on the auditorium. And usually I would send coffee and donuts out to the people who were picketing, our contribution to them. They were a little embarrassed to take this coffee from.
So Pete really does, and you really do believe in the concept of the First Amendment.
Oh, absolutely.
Even if the other guys are calling you names.
Yes, absolutely.
Harold, have there been any disappointments that you could point to in your life? Things that you wish you had either done over or done differently?
I can't think of it. You did what had to be done at the given time. You rationalize what you do and you do it. There's no guarantee that anything will succeed. The only guarantee is doing it. That's it. And there'd be enough reasons why you wouldn't do things, because that's the easiest way to get out of it, by not doing it.
The office I'm talking to you here, still a very busy office, as people can hear, literally next door to Carnegie Hall. Did you do that on purpose?
No, because at that time, I've been in this building for over 30 years. I moved 3 or 4 times. But generally, if you're in this kind of a business, you were in and around the Broadway area. Today, you can be anywhere.
When you produced the films, Alice's Restaurant, and did all of those, was that very different for you?
Different in the respect that a lot of the responsibilities of doing your film are in the hands of other people.
So you had to let go a little.
So you've got a committee, 15 people doing your picture. And everybody has their own autonomy. And the boss of it all is the director, not the producer. In fact, when we did the film Bound for Glory, I had this difficulties with the director, or disagreements with him. And he kind of retaliated by not letting me on the set for a day or two. But it was a good film.
What did you think of Alice's Restaurant, the film?
It's a hard film to do. It was a good film.
This song's called Alice's Restaurant. It's about Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's Restaurant is not the name of the restaurant, that's just the name of the song. And that's why I call the song Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant.
I live 5 minutes from that church. And Arlo, of course, is a national hero to our radio listeners and been very helpful to us and wonderful over the years. You've watched him and you raised money for the Guthrie Children's Fund. I've often wondered about that because I came to some of those concerts. And I'm wondering, did they need it? And did it help them in their lives?
The Guthrie Children's Fund was, their whole education was paid for from those funds, yes. And it wasn't that big a fund. It wasn't $100,000 involved.
How did you feel about making that little contribution to Woody and to the family?
Well, I was doing it because it had to be done. You can't let Woody's family just disappear. Now, Woody himself was someone who was not overly concerned about money, because he never had any. And when money was started to come in from songs being recorded, then you had to control it and literally take it away from him so that he doesn't spend it loosely. Mm. And actually, some of the first monies that he made, his wife was able to get a dance studio. She was a dancer. And they lived for some time on the studio income.
I talk to Arlo every once in a while because, of course, his mother was Jewish and he was bar mitzvah raised in Brooklyn.
I was to the bar mitzvah.
Were you? You went to the bar mitzvah? Now, that's interesting. What was
that like? The bar mitzvah was at a dance studio on 2nd Avenue. I remember, of course, Woody was there. Pete, all of the Weavers were there. Cisco Houston, who was in town, was there. Sonny Terry was there. Alan Lomax, and I remember that Arlo always felt that everyone was paying more attention to Woody than to him during the bar mitzvah. And it was a fun thing.
Wow. Harold, the concept of management itself, managing bands, managing folk music people, has it changed? In other words, has the job changed?
Yes, it's changed because the business has changed. It's much more open. Four areas.
Transparent, as we say.
Yeah, completely changed.
Pete talked about some of the shenanigans that have gone on, the changing of 11 words in a song so that somebody else can take all the rights and all the money, yeah, like Wimoway and some of these others. Does that bother you?
Yeah, because it's, to me, it's really theft, intellectual theft.
Legal intellectual theft.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Have you ever gotten involved in more traditional politics in which you see something like this kind of legal intellectual theft and say, well, that law ought to be changed, and talk to congressmen and other people about changing the law?
No, I haven't. They're not interested. This is a job for a strong organization or society to undertake, whether it's ASCAP or BMI. It's for these people to do this. It's a big job.
Anything get you angry?
Annoyed.
What?
Annoyed at these shenanigans going on.
Harold Leventhal, tell me a little bit about your memories of Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, in 1933, in the town where Ellenville, New York, I came from, during the summer, he was governor of the state of New York, and he was really announcing that he's going to run for president. So he made a trip through the Ulster County to win local support, and it was announced that he was coming to Ellenville. So we all went into town to see the man. And I kind of noticed that he was helped up the stairs of the hotel. He was given a chair and he sat down. I went up and I sat next to him. During the whole time he was there, I didn't say a word. And he looked at me and that was it. But I've been, of course, a great admirer of Roosevelt.
You think he was the greatest president in your lifetime?
Absolutely, absolutely.
How important do you, having dealt with all of these folk artists, think that the folk movement as we knew it, how important do you think it's been in the way it's influenced contemporary music?
Well, I think every element of music influences the next stage of music. Certainly, folk music has been a tremendous influence in the rock scene, whether it was Bob Dylan or whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Paul Simon. They've got their background from that kind of music. They take it a step further, or they meld it into the trends of the pick of the day. And it will always have an influence. I don't know what 10 years from now, who comes up, but it will be there because that music is so much part of American culture.
There was a film making fun of contemporary folk music called Mighty Wind.
Yes.
And some people say that part of the satire was based on you know, your management of all of these people. I hated the film, to tell you the truth. I may be the only guy who did, because I didn't like the fact that they were trivializing the music. Yet, I wondered whether you saw it, whether you had a reaction to it.
Yeah, I saw it. I just left me nonplussed. I was told by someone in the film that I should be assured it's not about me. And it wasn't, as far as I can see.
Nor
nothing
I.
To do.
Yeah.
But I was just amused on it. It's a 10-minute joke.
Exactly right. Now, there was people who came after the Weavers and some of the others, and they were some of these groups who were sort of portrayed in this film, who were sort of silly. They wore silly clothes, and they trivialized the music. So from that point of view, I wasn't terribly upset with making fun of some of those folks. But when you mess around with my heroes, that's another whole story. Tell me about Dylan.
Well, the early years, I spent a lot of time with him. He used to come up to the office quite a lot. And I see him from time to time. We're not buddies to that extent, but he's got his own way of doing things.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, for the times they are a-changing.
I wrote in a column once that he was a great writer and a great performer. But unlike Pete or Johnny Cash, he was a guy I wouldn't particularly look forward to eating lunch with. Is that an unfair assessment?
Yeah, I think it is. I've had lunch with him. So. He's a very shy person.
Is that what it is?
I'm talking, you mentioned Johnny Cash. He asked me to be his manager at one time.
Is that right?
I turned him down.
Why?
Well, it was during his drug period, and he mentioned that sometimes it would be difficult for me to get to meet with him or see him or even communicate. Well, I didn't want to relate to someone that was difficult. Also, his living in out in Tennessee, New York, was too different. And I was very friendly with him. He was very good to Pete.
Yes, he was.
And I think what people don't know that he threatened to leave his show because they didn't want Pete on his show. We never told that to Pete at that time.
So. But Pete certainly recognizes what Johnny Cash did in insisting that he be on the show.
Yeah. He threatened to leave the show.
What do you think of that?
And there's a guy that doesn't have the political background that's necessary for that.
Harold Leventhal, we just appreciate everything that you've done, and you've done an extraordinary job in this industry. You've got guts, you've got class. You really deserve this great honor. It's really just a wonderful thing to watch happening, and how many other managers can say that this has come to them? Very few. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Three men who died at Gettysburg, now lion soldiers' graves, but there they stem, the slavery tide, and there the faith was saved. Wasn't that a time? Our hand to other neighbors, far and near, to friends in every land. Isn't this a time? Isn't this a time? A time to free the soul of man. Isn't this a wonderful time? Isn't this a wonderful time?